You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, as John Kerry spends much of his week between Tel Aviv and Cairo, we ask what the US Secretary of State can contribute to halting the violence in Israel and Palestine. We also assess China-US relations and discuss what a post-coup Thailand and a post-election Indonesia mean for the power balance in Southeast Asia. Also coming up...
It's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
We head back to the 1970s, a glorious and golden age for the beautiful game. All that, plus we speak to our correspondent in Athens and review this week's top books with Kathy Retzenbrick. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, as you would expect, rather a lot to pack into the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Suzanne Chislett with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. The UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, says he's appalled at an Israeli attack on a UN school in Gaza, which has killed at least 15 people, including women, children and UN staff. Health officials in Gaza say 200 people were injured when shells struck the building. It was sheltering hundreds of Palestinians from the rising violence. Israel hasn't directly commented, but it's previously said it's only targeting Hamas rocket sites and smuggling tunnels. The British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond is the latest international diplomat to visit the Middle East to push for peace. He spoke after meeting Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem and reaffirmed the UK's commitment to Israel's right to defend itself.
But we are gravely concerned by the ongoing heavy level of civilian casualties. We want to see a ceasefire quickly agreed. We welcomed the earlier ceasefire proposal by Egypt, and we were grateful to you, Prime Minister, for your immediate agreement to it. We are disappointed that Hamas has apparently once again rejected ceasefire proposals.
French fighter planes are still trying to find the crash site of an Air Algérie plane, which is believed to have gone down in stormy weather over Mali. The plane was less than an hour into its journey above the Sahara from Burkina Faso to Algiers. Almost half of the 110 passengers on board were French. The six crew members were all Spanish. Investigators looking into the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 say they found no evidence that either of the aircraft's two black boxes were tampered with. The Dutch Safety Board says information has now been successfully downloaded from the Boeing 777's data recorder. The analysis is being done by Britain's Air Accident Investigation Branch at Farnborough. Robert Fox, defence editor for the London Evening Standard, told Monocle 24 it's the best place for the work to be carried out.
It's a very good collective memory of expertise there. And the sort of techniques that will be involved in looking at MH17 will be the kinds of things that have evolved and they have developed from, for instance, like the Lockerbie disaster.
The UN civil aviation body is expected to hold a meeting in Montreal next week following the downing of the Malaysia Airlines plane. The International Civil Aviation Organization, lobby groups and others will discuss what to do about airspace over conflict zones. There's been criticism that flights had not been diverted from routes over Ukraine, where government and rebel forces were fighting. In Ukraine, the country's prime minister tendered his resignation after two parties, which were part of the governing coalition, withdrew. One politician claimed the move was to rid the chamber of Moscow agents. The move's been welcomed by the president, Petro Poroshenko, as it allows him to call a new election. Rival armed groups in the Central African Republic have signed a ceasefire agreement aimed at ending over a year of religious fighting. The mainly Muslim Seleka rebels and the largely Christian anti-Balaka militia have held 3 days of talks to reach the deal. The conflict's seen more than a million people, a quarter of the country's population, leave their homes. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, told Monocle 24 that while he isn't optimistic the ceasefire will hold, it is a step in the right direction.
This particular conflict is rather different from the ones that have happened beforehand. It has specific roots and reasons, and there are specific ways out of it. It just requires a significantly larger engagement from from the African Union and the outside world in terms of humanitarian funding, because hunger is one of the real drivers of this violence.
The Sudanese woman who fled to Italy after being spared a death sentence in Sudan for renouncing Islam has met the Pope. Maryam Yahya Ibrahim Ishaq arrived in Rome with her family after spending more than a month in the US Embassy in Khartoum. Her sentence and jailing was condemned around the world. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Chislett, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news is Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and the political historian Dr. James Boyes. James and Isabel, thank you very much for coming today. We're going to begin by discussing John Kerry. He became US Secretary of State in early 2013, and since then it seems as if he has been in one ongoing round of negotiation covering pretty much every major world issue, from nuclear talks with Iran to chemical weapons discussions on Syria, the recently failed Israel-Palestine peace talks, and more talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov than frankly either of them would have liked. This week he was on the road again, this time in Cairo, trying to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. James Boyes, you have to at least admire John Kerry's ambition here, don't you?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. He's got a very tough job. I thought one of the smart things, to be fair, that Hillary Clinton did when she became sextant in the first term was to convince Barack Obama of the need to put regional envoys in, people, you know, like Richard Holbrooke, for example, George Mitchell, to do a lot of the localized focus work to allow her to sort of roam around a little bit. I can't help but think that Kerry might have been well advised to try to follow that model because, as we've discussed on the show before, at the moment he's doing a lot of juggling. And the danger, of course, is that you're flying around the world trying to solve one crisis after another, and you're basically firefighting. And you've got to ask, you admire his dedication to the cause, but is much getting achieved? And at the moment, it's not necessarily demonstrable that that's the case.
Isabel Hilton, do you feel that that would have been a wiser strategy for John Kerry to take, to actually have envoys who can really own an issue, and he can just be there as the backup, as it were?
Well, I think that I'd have a slightly different take on why Hillary Clinton did that. Kerry is a failed presidential candidate. Clinton is a prospective one, and I think that she didn't want failures on her watch as Secretary of State. And so I think that it was quite convenient for her to, you know, put Richard Holbrooke in charge of intractable issues. You know, she didn't really want it. She couldn't get tough with Israel because she's thinking ahead to the election. And actually, if you look at what she achieved with this high-level view, I'm not sure that the pivot to Asia was a tremendous success. She didn't resolve the Middle East.
We seem to have pivoted back now.
We seem to have been pushed back. And actually, Kerry, Kerry is a risk-taker. He's hyperactive, and you may say, well, he hasn't got very far. But Iran was a high-risk venture, and I think a very good one. And I think that he will, you know, in the end, probably have more achievement on his, you know, on his list than perhaps Hillary Clinton did have.
And that's a fair point, James, isn't it? That, you know, Secretary of State needs to be a position where someone is going to take risks. We are not going to solve any of these big long-term issues which have bedeviled particularly the Middle East for decades unless someone is prepared to think, you know what, it doesn't matter if I lose an election in 3 years' time, or I don't need to worry about standing for election in 3 years' time. I just need to sort this thing out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think John Kerry will benefit from a lot of the legwork that Hillary put in her first term, to be quite honest. I think a lot of the things that we're talking about here, you know, the degree to which we can really give him any credit for what was initiated with Iran, I think is somewhat debatable. I'd also take issue, to be honest with you, Isabel, with respect to that. John Kerry, as much as Hillary Clinton was a failed presidential candidate, they've both run and failed to win the presidency. I think Hillary's obviously got a potentially bigger, brighter future, assuming that she runs that. It's, and
but
I think
Hillary
that she certainly
actually run for president. She didn't get the nomination.
Well, she certainly ran for she came very, very
well,
close.
Well, I guess anyway, the point...
But she still has this in prospect.
And that's the point, I guess, is that John Kerry, you know, even in his own, at times, possibly fevered imaginations, even at 2 a.m. when he's lying in a hotel bed in Cairo thinking, what does the future lie ahead for me? Yeah. He's not thinking, ah, yes, one day the White House.
No, absolutely not. I think this is his swan song, effectively, and I think he's going to do a credible job on it, and there's no doubt about that, I think. And it'll be interesting to see what he achieves in the coming 2 years, I think.
Isabel, is actually the big problem for John Kerry when it comes to, you know, this situation right now in Gaza, the fact that he is trying to play the role of negotiator and middleman. And frankly, if you're Palestinian or you live in Gaza, you'll look at John Kerry and think, you know, he's not an independent arbiter.
You might think that. I think he's got a bigger problem. Frankly, I think the Palestinians could use all the help they can get. But I think that his specific problem in that situation is that, actually quite unusually, I think, for the United States, he's being treated with fairly open contempt by Egypt, certainly, and to some extent by Israel. I think neither side, when these two intractable forces that you want to get to the negotiating table, they have a common interest in destroying Hamas. They're not really ready to listen. And certainly the Egyptians have treated him with, you know, marked lack of respect pretty much every time he's been there. So I think he's got a tough job there. And you know, he doesn't really have parties that are interested in cooperation or as yet feel that they need to.
And I guess that's the big problem as well, isn't it, James, that you can't, it's all very well saying you want to negotiate on an issue, but if actually you can't, you know, none of the people you want to negotiate with are particularly interested in talking, then there's only so much you can do. You end up doing this sort of shuttle between Tel Aviv and Cairo and back to Washington doing press conferences.
You're absolutely right. You know, we've seen this before in the past with American secretaries of state and with high-level envoys. The parties on the ground are intractable, and what can you do? You've got to be seen to be doing something, so you end up engaging in shuttle diplomacy. But if, as Isabel rightly points out, there's a sense that the president's main envoy and chief diplomat overseas isn't, you know, getting the respect that his office requires and demands at that point, what do you do? Because Obama isn't about to start getting his hands dirty at this point with so little time left on his watch, I can assure you.
And not just Obama, Isabel, that there is no one else, is there? You know, we've had 5 years now of the European Union having its own foreign affairs chief, and Cathy Ashton certainly, I think most observers would say, done better than many people expected. But let's face it, the bar was set pretty low. No one is actually saying, hey, I know, let's send Cathy Ashton to Gaza, she'll sort this out, or indeed any other European leader.
No, indeed. And Cathy Ashton is coming to the end of her mandate, so and the European Union is in some disarray. So actually, you know, again, I would speak up for Cathy Ashton. I think she did, you know, pretty stoic and good work in a number of situations, in Iran most notably. But actually, this isn't the moment, and she hasn't got any heft in this situation. Mm. It would be pointless, I think, it would be a waste of her capital and her remaining time.
So frankly, James, whether we like it or not, John Kerry is the man for all of these, because there simply is no one else.
There is no one else. You know, Kissinger used to say famously, if I call Europe, who do I talk to about foreign affairs? And whilst Cathy Ashton's done a decent enough job, you know, her mandate, as Isabel rightly pointed out, is now up. It's going to be someone else to do this. They're going to need some time to get adjusted to the job. The EU just never continually manages to bat at the level it should be at this point. And there is no counterweight to US foreign policy in that region, I'm afraid.
No, I was going to say, would anyone call Xi Jinping Isabel? But I think we're a long way off the moment where China decides to involve itself in the Middle East. I want to talk about China now, though, another region where there is, for the US, quite a lot at stake. Mm-hmm. After hacking allegations against China earlier this month, John Kerry, him again, met with Xi Jinping in an attempt to patch up their strained relationship. Since then, we've seen a joint maritime exercise, a fast food scandal, and the announcement that both superpowers will partake in Ban Ki-moon's climate change summit in September. Isabel, the relationship between the US and China, it's been always slightly strained and slightly difficult. How do you compare the relationship now compared to other times over the last 20 or 30 years?
Oh, gosh, that's a long stretch. it was looking pretty bleak, I have to say, about 2 months ago. I was at the Shangri-La dialogue in May, and it was a pretty open slanging match. Certainly the Chinese, you know, making it quite clear that they regard the United States' time in Asia as over. The Chinese are much more assertive. They'd annoyed all the smaller neighbours, but frankly, they're also the largest trading partner of those neighbours, so there's a limited amount that they can do. And the US was trying to galvanise the everyone but China into a condemnation of China's behaviour, really quite successfully, but that's about as far as it goes. Anyway, it was a pretty toxic atmosphere. So I think that the strategic dialogue, which got a rather downbeat press, is nevertheless, you know, it's better to talk than not to talk. It's good that these things still happen. They didn't break down. They, you know, chewed over the usual subjects, currency manipulation, cybersecurity, etc. But they really did make some progress on climate. And frankly, from where I sit, making progress on climate is very important.
And in fact, just to stick on that point, Isabel, do you think actually that the US and China should just accept that when it comes to defense issues in Southeast Asia and trade issues, you know, they're not going to agree and they're not going to make friends, whereas there are some issues like climate where they can actually work together?
Absolutely. And this is really what they do. I mean, they're both trying to define a relationship. You've got a possibly declining superpower, but nevertheless still the world's superpower. You have a rising power. And they're trying to get to a relationship in which they manage their differences and recognizing that there always will be differences, but hoping that it won't break down to the kind of 19th or early 20th century contest of a violent nature. And I think, you know, both sides have a huge interest, and certainly we all have a huge interest in them succeeding in that.
James Boyes, the relationship between the Obama administration and Xi Jinping was they started work on this quite early when Xi Jinping was still vice premier. He was invited over to hang out with Joe Biden. I think was it basketball they went to see or baseball? I think it was definitely one of those.
Not sure I know the difference.
So they sort of tried to build up a relationship with Xi Jinping as much as they could, not really knowing much about him. Do you think that has made any sort of difference at all to their relationship?
It's perhaps a little early to tell, to be quite honest, and the extent to which this is going to come down to personalities is difficult to judge also. Plus, I would also say that if you're really trying to court the future Chinese leadership, I'm not sure that Uncle Joe Biden would be the place to start necessarily.
Oh, I don't know. You
could show them the great views of the Delaware countryside on the Amtrak he takes every Friday night.
Exactly. I think it's a perfect thing. So, you know, go and watch basketball or baseball, or indeed American football, any sport with Joe Biden, I think will be an experience.
You might be right. You may know more about it than I do. But this idea, I think, that trying to look at how, you know, the Obama administration has tried to approach China, it's fascinating. In the first term, for example, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on, this idea of a Pacific pivot that Hillary Clinton spoke of so openly, that really seems to have taken a back seat now under John Kerry. We were talking earlier on about the differences between the first and second term. Hillary, I think, focused very much upon trying to talk about that move to the Pacific. There was the moves to establish naval bases, for example, and more of a maritime presence coming off the Australian coast. With Kerry, I think you've seen much more of an old European approach, effectively. And this in many ways mirrors what Clinton did as president back in the 90s, the idea that you start trying to talk about a better relationship with China and you suddenly realise very quickly that that's very, very difficult to get any benefits from. So you move very quickly back to first principles, which is a European approach.
And just finally on this point, Isabel Hilton, how important does China see relations with America? Is it its most important relationship?
It is certainly its most important relationship. It's actually not its biggest trade relationship. That's the European Union, but they have the Kissinger problem with Europe. In terms of,
you know, they just speak to the Germans.
They only speak to the Germans, exactly. So in terms of, you know, what they would like to be, who they measure themselves against, where they see modernity, all these things, it's America that fills their imagination and their strategic thinking.
Isabel Hilton, James Boyes, we'll leave it there just for now. In a moment, we'll be talking about Thailand and Indonesia. You're listening to Midori House. Stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big, bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today, Isabel Hilton and James Boyes, here in the studio. Now, Thailand had a coup. Indonesia had what US President Barack Obama called free and fair elections at two very different transitions of power. Isabel Hilton, these are two of the biggest countries in the region. They have both had their issues, shall we say, with military dictatorships. Indonesia had a 32-year rule of a General Suharto, but since then seems to have made big progress. Is now, you know, the world's second largest democracy. Certainly, sitting from London, what's happened in Indonesia in recent weeks seems to have been a bit of a success. When you're talking to people in the region, do they share that view?
Absolutely, and I think that we pay relatively little attention to either Indonesia or Malaysia, in fact, I mean, in terms of the politics. And these are huge and important countries, you know, 250 million people in Indonesia, a long and complicated election. But the second peaceful transition since the end of the dictatorship, there was a moment when it looked as though it was going to be contested by a general, the rival candidate, the losing candidate looked as though he was going to contest it. But, you know, we seem to be in a position now where Joko Widodo is putting together a coalition that he needs. He has a lot of problems, but nevertheless, we have to recognise that this is a good moment for Indonesia.
James Boyes, Joko Widodo may look like he's in his early 20s, but he's actually, I'm assured, in his early 50s. But he certainly is a fresh face in Indonesian politics. He's had some success as governor of Jakarta and certainly been very, very popular there. Do you think that, he's been spoken about as this sort of new broom of new type of leader for Southeast Asia, not just Indonesia, but the region? There seems to be a lot of pressure on his shoulders.
Yeah, no doubt. I think the weight of expectation will be wearing heavily upon him, and it'll be fascinating to see what comes of this. Certainly, this idea, as Isabel rightly says, you know, there's not a lot of coverage necessary. We don't focus upon this. You could make an argument, I think, that maybe that's not a bad thing, because things are relatively quiet in some parts of that world, and it's only when it becomes problematic that we look at them. And thank goodness this transfer of power has gone so well, because, you know, with the world's, you know, largest Muslim country, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you know, there was all sorts of potential possibilities for crises there. So the fact that it has gone relatively smoothly, I think, is to the credit of what they've done in that country. And it will be fascinating to see whether he does emerge as a regional actor of renown, effectively, for the rest of the world, the EU and the United States, to really get behind and advocate moving forward.
And Isabel Hilton, compared to Thailand, which has just gone through another coup, it depends how you count them, but allegedly 13 in the last several decades. That's a country which had a lot of hope that you'd had, you know, some big changes, that the country is moving forward, had a growing economy, and now look, that much of that looks to have stalled.
But that's true. I mean, I think that the test for Indonesia would in some ways reflect some of the problems that Thailand had and the problems that brought people onto the street. You know, Indonesia has a lot of corruption. Indonesia's growth is not great. It's paying far more than it should in fuel subsidies. And no government has been able to really to cut those effectively because it brings people onto the streets. So, you know, I would not wish a Thai situation on Indonesia. But you can see that there are parallels in terms of the kind of problems that Indonesia is going to have to tackle. I have to say that the political depression in Thailand is quite serious at this point. There seems to be very little prospect of a return to democracy anytime soon, and it's not particularly helpful for the Thai economy, and certainly not helpful for Thai politics.
And Isabel, looking more generally within the Southeast Asia, obviously, you know, democracy has, shall we say, not quite been embedded within the region, because we've had a number of situations where we've either gone back to military dictatorships or they've struggled to come out of it. And yet there are some signs of hope. Indonesia one, the changes in Burma another. Are you half glass full, half glass empty, no glass at all?
I would say my glass is kind of teetering towards half full. I mean, it takes a long time for democracy to mature. It takes a long time to make the kind of transition from authoritarian society to functioning democracies. You can have elections, but you need to do something about embedded elites. You know, you need to do something about entrenched power structures and powerful armies. And those things take time. So I think that I don't think we're going backwards, really. I think we're there is the occasional wobble, but I would say that on the whole, it's okay.
James Boyce, going back to what we were talking about before about the US's pivot to Asia, which perhaps didn't quite happen. When the pivot was in place, or at least seemed to be happening, there wasn't huge amounts of talk, correct me if I'm wrong, about the promotion of democracy within the region. This was more about trade links and about perhaps being not necessarily a threat to China, but sort of countering the threat that some of those countries felt towards China, wasn't it?
You're absolutely right. And I'm glad you raised that point, because I've just been doing some writing about it today, actually. This idea of promoting democracy, of course, is embedded in classic US grand strategy and foreign policy, irrespective really of administration to administration. I think the outside world tends to focus upon it more at certain times, particularly, for example, when George W. Bush was president. But the idea that what you saw with Barack Obama was very much sort of talking about trade. There's obviously an undercurrent, at the very least, of military repositioning vis-a-vis, let's not say the word China, but it's out there anyway. But certainly, I thought you saw that what Hillary was trying to do was a sex that was very much raise the awareness and the role of women in that part of the world, for example, with certain key individuals in mind. But, you know, whether that's continued under John Kerry, I think is questionable. Certainly democratic promotion in that part of the world has not necessarily gone according to plan, but I don't think it ever does, quite frankly.
Isabel, we were talking before about how China's most important relationship is with the US. Its biggest trade relationship is with the European Union. Countries like Thailand and Indonesia, relatively speaking, on its doorstep. How important are the relations between those countries? Obviously, China's not going to be promoting democracy in any way, but how important are those links between those countries?
Well, they're important. China prefers to have bilateral links rather than, you know, multilateral institutions. And one of the contests between the US and China in the region is not so much the promotion of democracy, certainly not in China, But the question of rules-based systems, it's whether, you know, if you have a dispute in the South China Sea or a dispute over overflight, you can go to arbitration in The Hague, a question of whether, you know, whether you can appeal to multilateral or international bodies to solve your problems. China always prefers, because it's always the biggest country, to do things bilaterally. And the US has been talking a great deal about the notion of the rule of law, if you like, internationally. And that is, so it's postulating a rules-based system against a big country system, which is ironic given the way the US has behaved in the past, but nevertheless. I also think that, you know, the US's promotion of democracy is pretty pragmatic and ad hoc. You may remember Gene Kirkpatrick's famous, you know, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch, yep. remark. And certainly, you know, when I covered Latin America, democracy promotion was not really top of the agenda. It sort of comes, it goes in and out of fashion. And when there's a choice between security and democracy, the US will always go for security.
Yes, and it's the countries that have had democratic presidents ousted by US-backed dictators don't tend to forget that.
Indeed.
Isabel Hilton and James Boyce, we'll leave it there. Thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Right then, second half coming up, in which we'll be talking all about football, even though the World Cup is over. But, you know, the new season's starting soon. We're also going to be in Athens, finding out all about the latest news there, and we'll be flicking through some of the week's best books. But first, Suzanne Chislett is here with the news.
Thank you. The UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, says he's appalled at an attack on a UN school in Gaza, which has killed at least 15 people, including women, children and UN staff. Health officials in Gaza say 200 people were injured when Israeli shells struck the building, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinians from the rising violence. Israel has not yet directly commented. French fighter planes are still trying to find the crash site of an Air Algérie plane, which is believed to have gone down in stormy weather over Mali. Almost half of the 110 passengers on board the flight from Burkina Faso to Algiers were French. Investigators looking into the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 say they found no evidence that either of the aircraft's two black boxes were tampered with. The Dutch Safety Board says information's now been successfully downloaded from the Boeing 777's data recorders. And rival armed groups in the Central African Republic have signed a ceasefire agreement aimed at ending over a year of religious fighting. The conflict has seen more than a million people, a quarter of the country's population, flee their homes. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for us to cross to Athens to speak to our correspondent there, Natalie Savarakis. Natalie, welcome to Midori House. In a moment, you're going to tell us all about a mystery crocodile. But first, more serious news. The government is trying to introduce a new bill that's going to allow construction on Greek beaches. Understandably, not all of you are delighted about this, are you?
No, it's caused, quite a controversy in Greece, but it looks like they're actually backtracking on this. Interestingly enough, just a few weeks ago, I had a talk about this with the Secretary General of Greece, who deals with the state property. And he said essentially what the government wanted to do with this new bill was mark the country's 16,000 kilometers of shoreline, which so far wasn't actually clearly delineated. So they said that that's what they want to do, but in the same time they want to also attract investment, because obviously where you know what the coastline is, it's easier to know where the other one can build a hotel if he wishes to do so. But at the same time, he insisted he wants to protect Greece's environment. Now, of course, they've always had the tough balancing act to protect the environment and attract development, and that's proven throughout the country with the many illegal constructions that are just by the seaside.
Now, obviously, there are financial reasons for why the government is considering allowing people to build on the beaches. Is there some level of understanding amongst Greeks that, well, look, maybe we have to allow some of this? Or is this one of those things that people feel, look, whatever our financial issues, this just shouldn't happen?
Greeks are divided about this. First, you have the ones that, of course, want to understand the countries, you know, in dire straits. They've been like that for the past 6 years. They desperately need to attract investors, especially foreign investors. But the thing is that in Greece, unfortunately, many things just don't happen, you know, with the following the legislations and the rule book. And many things can happen illegally, or you can be quite flexible with the rules and build many unlicensed buildings. You know, constructions, and let the authorities turn a blind eye. And I think that's the big concern of most Greeks is, will the authorities go through with allowing construction, but, you know, protecting the environment at the same time? And as I mentioned earlier, that's a problem in this country that too often, and the you know, the living and existing examples are around us, it hasn't happened. So if you relax the legislation as it is and spur development, it just will be at the detriment of the environment. And Greece has a lot of natural and you know, ecosystems that are just, you know, very, very threatened at the moment by this construction.
Okay. And now a left-wing militant group in Greece, I'll try only the English name, Revolutionary Struggle, you can give us the Greek. Their leader was arrested last week, and the police are now trying to crack down on this group. Tell us more.
Επαναστατικός Αγώνας, as the group is known in Greece. I mean, they're actually responsible, just to give you some background, for the most famous or notorious, actually, attack was against the U.S. embassy and in 2007 when they used a rocket that propelled a fire, like a rocket propelled grenade against the U.S. embassy in central Athens. They're also accused of seriously injuring a riot policeman for an explosion outside the country's stock exchange. So pretty serious militants here. The leader and his wife of this group were arrested years ago, but because they were in pre-trial detention, they were eventually released, and they were called to show up at the police stations. At some once they just stopped showing up, and since they've been on the hunt, the police has been hunting them down, and they finally apprehended them last week in a very famous and dangerous shootout right in the center of Athens near Sintagma Square. And now they're just looking for the wife of the leader, Nikos Mazyotis, and other potential accomplices.
Does that mean that they feel that this group is pretty much coming to the end of its natural life? I mean, did they ever have much support?
Well, I think what this group and many of the like-minded left-wing anarchist militant groups, this one actually has been characterized as terrorist because of the severity of the attacks, they all violently oppose the system, capitalism, and especially the political establishment, whom they find it, and like many Greeks, responsible for the country's, you know, the serious financial predicament. Obviously, the way they go about it, most people won't agree with it, but some might, you might find some Greeks that say, well, you know, these people are scaring the politicians and they're the only people who are actually acting upon it. Obviously, these are the most radical voices in society. But, you know, you might find some Greeks who will jokingly say that.
Okay. And just finally, as I mentioned at the start, there is a mystery crocodile in Crete. Please explain.
Aha, well, like around the world, you find many people tend to, you know, have an interesting choice for pets. So authorities there think that someone decided to adopt the crocodile when it was cute and relatively short. Now it's 6 foot. And when it kind of grew out of the bathroom tub, they decided to dump him in a lake in the southern island of Crete. And so he was spotted in this lake at the beginning of the month. The authorities there have been trying to get a hold of this crocodile, which apparently has been accused of devouring lambs and ducks. They've been unable to do so far. He's captured Cephis, is his name, the pet name that the Cretans have given this reptile, strolling around the Rethymno area. And the authorities have said that if they are unable to lure him by dangling chickens to him, they might have to call in the experts from Morocco.
Well, there we are then. Please do keep us updated with what happens to that crocodile. Natalie Svarakis in Athens, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insights.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Shimer Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. The beautiful game has rarely looked quite so beautiful. A new book, The Age of Innocence, Football in the 1970s, lovingly details some of the stars of the game during what some would describe as its golden age. This was the time of Pelé, when Brazilian football teams actually played like Brazilian football teams. It was also the time of George Best and the first Playboy footballers. One of his famous quotes adorns the back cover. I spent a lot of money on booze, birds and fast cars. The rest I just squandered. Rule Golden is the book's editor and he joins us now from our New York bureau. Rule, welcome to Midori House. And firstly, congratulations on what is a really beautiful book.
Thank you so much. It was very nice to hear and thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
What is it about the 70s and football that makes it such a great era to look back on photographically?
It's a very good question. I think what's interesting for us is really it kicks off, pun intended, with the 1970 World Cup and the, as you said, the Brazilian team when they played like Brazil. And it's really when the game became truly global, thanks to the World Cup being televised in color. But it still maintained a certain innocence and a sort of sense of wonder. I mean, I remember as a kid sort of seeing the Dutch team in the 1974 World Cup. And this was the first time that I'd seen this team. And it wasn't like these days where every game is endlessly sort of recycled on YouTube. You know, when Holland turned out in the 1974 World Cup, this is the first time that a lot of people had seen it.
So there was no European Champions League on every night. No one was watching La Liga matches on Sunday nights. You weren't YouTubing Ibrahimovic's latest goal.
Exactly. It wasn't. There wasn't any sense that you're being oversaturated with the product. So it was that sense that you were discovering football, but also the teams were played in a very sort of attractive, uncynical way. And as you said yourself in your introduction, the players themselves were sort of glamorous and they were also very smart, but there was always there were also mavericks to a certain extent. So, you know, we felt the combination of the players, the fashion, the girlfriends, the cars, it would make an interesting book for us photographically.
You mentioned the girlfriends. I mean, one thing that strikes me looking at these photos is that there was obviously this trend in the 70s to photograph players in fashionable clothes, but have their girlfriends in the pictures too, dressed in the team's kit. There's, I think, half a dozen sort of throughout the book of players like that with just randomly their girlfriend there wearing their kit.
That's right. It's girlfriends with girlfriends and wives with their kit on, which I think is probably a good thing. Yeah, I think it was just a way of sort of introducing a sort of element of kind of fun, contextualizing what the players did. But yeah, I mean, there's one particular cool shot of Bobby Moore with his wife Tina Moore, and they're in a wood somewhere, and she's photographed in the England jersey, and of course, this being the 70s, the skirt is pretty short, or the jersey is pretty short.
This was really sort of a generation where you had your first sort of set of international stars. We've mentioned Pelé, you mentioned Bobby Moore. There's also Johan Cruyff as well, the great Dutch master, who's pictured extensively throughout the book. Was that something deliberate that you thought, you know, we want to actually focus on these stars as well as sort of the general beautiful game?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I felt like there are a lot of football books that are either about a team or about a competition, but then I've never seen a football book that focus on the era to the extent that we do. And I think the players, I mean, Cruyff's a good example. He was, you know, he grew up in Amsterdam. I think his mother was a cleaner for Ajax, and he was very much part of the Ajax Academy. But he was also had this kind of Euro sort of cool about him. He was quite an outspoken individual. He was the player, but also to some extent the coach, the manager, the heart and the brains of the team. So In the essay at the front by a writer called Barney Rone, which is a great essay he wrote for us, you know, he describes Beckenbauer as a managing director in shorts. And I think, you know, this was something that we also liked about the players, is that they had this certain kind of individualism to them. And these days, these superstars are very much, you know, surrounded by lawyers, by sponsors, by agents. And, you know, these players are really had free reign both on and off the pitch. I mean, we have a photograph in the book of Pelé and Beckenbauer, you know, naked in the showers. And, you know, you really see everything. And it's kind of hard to imagine, you know. It's impossible to imagine anything like that.
It wouldn't happen now. I mean, as you say, you know, the book's subtitled The Age of Innocence, and there really is a sort of an innocence to it all. The access, whether it's, yes, Pelé naked in the shower, or whether it's shots of people at home. Also, the lack of sponsorship. Obviously, they were starting to get sponsorship, but there's no sort of need for someone sort of to show off their latest Adidas boots in a photo shoot. They're just standing there looking cool.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, money was starting to creep into the game, and you know, with the players we've talked about now, you know, Pelé, Cruyff, you know, they were on big. They were starting to negotiate very good contracts for themselves, but on the whole, you know, people played for the love of the game. I mean, it sounds kind of corny, but I think like all corn, you know, there's an element of truth in it, and that's something that we really wanted to capture in the book, that there is this kind of this innocence, this joy, this spontaneity, as you said, the fact that it isn't this. You know, football is—it's not a brand yet to the extent that it is these days. It's not this money-producing, money-guzzling machine.
Just finally, the one thing I do have to take issue with you is that your 1970s dream team at the back, which is sort of lined up with their Panini-style stickers, you've gone for a rather modern 4-2-3-1 formation. I'm unsure about George Best on the right, and also Pelé as your sole centre-forward. Is that as a sort of a false nine? I'll take that as you haven't really thought much about how they're going to play, have you?
Well, I think the idea was, I think the idea was really to present, you know, a it was more like a fantasy football team.
Yeah, defensively, you know, they're not that strong. I'm sorry.
They're a little all... Well, also the defensive midfielder wasn't a big phenomenon in the 70s.
Anyway, Rule Golden, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that there, mainly also because we need to play a song, and you might like this. We want to play a football song. I'm afraid there are no good football songs from the 70s, but there was one absolutely amazing football song in the 90s, in 1990 in fact. We'll play that right now. Rule Golden, thank you very much for joining us. The book is called The Age of Innocence, Football in the 1970s. This is New Order, World in Motion.
Well, some of the crowd are on the pitch.
Well, some of the crowd... You can be slow or fast, but you must get to the line.
Oh, can I just apologise for not playing all of the John Barnes rap? Very sorry about that. That was World in Motion by New Order and the greatest rap star of all time, John Barnes. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're going to end with a book review. Cathy Rensenbrick, associate editor of The Bookseller and also from We Love This Book, has slipped into the studio while I was trying to sing John Barnes. Luckily, she wasn't joining in. Sorry, I don't mean to say luckily, as in that would have been a bad thing, but luckily it didn't get too out of hand. Cathy, welcome. We're going to talk about Thirst. We're going to talk about After Me Comes the Flood. But first, The Miniaturist by Jesse Burton.
Yes, so 17th century Holland, Amsterdam, a young woman called Nella Ortmann. And can I just tell you that my Dutch husband has been giving me pronunciation lessons on these names, so it's to be hoped it's good. Nella Ortmann arrives from the country to the house of Johannes Brandt.
I think that one's right.
Yeah, as his new wife, basically, a country girl up to the city. He's a very prosperous merchant trader. He doesn't give her much attention. He does give her a very sumptuous present, an exact replica of the house that they live in, and she... in the absence of attention from him, commissions a miniaturist to build furniture for it.
Wow. And I assume it goes on from there.
It does. It's really one of the things I find interesting about it, actually. If ever you are in Amsterdam and can go to the Rijksmuseum, it is based, it's inspired by an actual cabinet house that it was a replica of the houses owned by a Petronella Ortmann. So that's the inspiration for the tale.
And what is it about this novel that makes it stand out for you?
I mean, it's very detailed and sumptuous as a reading experience. Everything's very well done. The way the people move through the streets of Amsterdam, the walking by the canals, the clothes and the furniture are all well done. And then there's just this great brooding presence about what's happening. As the miniaturist sends the intricately detailed little pieces of furniture to Nella for her house, they bear a slightly uncanny resemblance to what the reality in the house is. And a lot of the book is discovering what's the mystery behind the fact that her husband pays her no attention, and who's the miniaturist, and what's the mystery behind the fact that the miniaturist seems to know things about the household.
And the author, Jesse Burton.
Yeah, it's a debut. Very good. It'd be very interesting to see what she does next, because there doesn't seem to be an obvious... You know, sometimes an author writes a book and you can kind of see their career stretching out between them. But I'd be very interested to know, you know, will she look for another historical period? Where will she be going next?
So. Okay. Thirst by Kerry Hudson. It says here, an unconventional love story. No one ever has a book description saying this is a conventional love story, do they?
That's probably true, actually. I mean, this is a very unconventional love story, full of a sort of, well, two deeply flawed characters who sort of come together in a fraught, difficult, painful and impossible relationship. They meet when Dave, who's a security guard, sees Elena trying to steal shoes in the department store in Bond Street where he works.
Like all good love stories,
absolutely,
starts with theft.
And he lets her get away with it, and they sort of start a relationship. She's from Siberia, and there's lots of interesting and heartbreaking detail about how and why she ends up in England and why she's stealing shoes in a department store. This is Kerry Hudson's second novel. Her first novel was the rather magnificently titled Tony Hogan Bought Me an Ice Cream Float and Then He Stole My Ma. I think she's a
That's
really
a brilliant song.
And this one
is Just Thirst.
Just Thirst, yeah. Mm. So lots of words to one word. I love the way she gives voice to people who are less voiced than we would probably hope, both in our society and in our literature. And I think the characters in Tony Hogan are like that, and the characters, both Dave and Elena, are just the sorts of voices you don't hear very often in novels.
And does Siberia feel as realistic? Does she paint that as well as the scenes within London?
Yes, I think so. And it's interesting the way that the action moves. And then again, it's a very interesting, I think as the reader, you get to make your own mind up about the ending, about whether it's happy or not.
Okay, there we are. And finally, Sarah Perry's new book, After Me Comes the Flood.
Yes, so this is a very interesting debut. Very good review from John Burnside in The Guardian for this, said that it was Kafka meets Le Grand Merlin, which I thought was quite clever. It's about a man called John Cole who, London is in a drought, it's incredibly hot. He has a bookshop that nobody comes to, so he decides to shut up shop and head off to the country to visit his brother. His car breaks down, he gets in a state, he doesn't have a map, and he stumbles upon this very grand but dilapidated house. And the people in the house are expecting him. John Cole, they say, we were expecting you. And there's a room waiting for him.
Wow.
And
does it start off? I mean, obviously you say, mm-hmm. you know, London's experienced a drought, so it's not that realistic, although it has been quite mm-hmm. hot the last couple of months. Does it start out feeling quite realistic and then enter this strange world? Or is there that sort of sense of this is familiar but not quite right from
the start? Yeah, there's a floaty feel to the whole lot. You don't quite know where you are. You feel a bit disorientated. Some of it seems quite normal, you know, bookshops, cars, maps, but also not. And I think, again, that is quite well done because you do get the sense that, you know, that it could just be the heat that's disorientating or the sense that we're just slightly in a, not exactly parallel universe, but just slightly askew from where we normally would be.
I think many people feel like that.
Well, absolutely, anyway. Yes. I felt it was more like Kafka meets P.G. Woodhouse. Improve on John Burnside's comparison.
There we are. After Me Comes the Flood, Thirst, The Miniaturist. Kathy, if you had to pick one?
That's just too difficult. The Sarah Perry is really peculiar and haunting.
After Me Comes the Flood. There we are, Kathy Rensenbrick. Thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Isabel Hilton and James Boyes. Midori House was produced by Isabel Kayser, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lucy Atkinson. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up after the news with Suzanne, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.